All right, thank you. Welcome to the attorneys. The next case on our calendar this morning is the marriage of Schneider versus Schneider. Would each of the attorneys be sure to state their names for the record before beginning your argument so we have a record of who is speaking for our audio recording? With that, we will hear from counsel for appellant. You'll have 15 minutes for your argument with 5 minutes for rebuttal. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors and counsel. May it please the court. My name is Tim Simonson. I am the attorney representing the appellant. And may I proceed? Fantastic. Thank you. Your Honors, this case stems from a dissolution of marriage that was granted by the district court at the beginning, about a year ago, in May of 2021. Following a two-day trial early on in 2021, which stemmed from a rather lengthy dissolution proceeding that began in 2019 in the form of a child custody petition brought by the respondent. Your Honors, I will, for the sake of clarity, try my best to stick to the proper designations of appellant and respondent, but it might be easier if I just stick with father and mother, if that's all right with the court.
That would be easier for us as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honors. I am representing the father. The dissolution proceeding, Your Honors, was filed by the mother in 2018, actually. The parties had approximately 7 years of marriage before they separated in 2018. And they are the parents of a minor child. His name is Oren. Oren is now 5 years old. At the time of the dissolution of marriage, Your Honors, the minor child, Oren, was 4 years old, and it's about Oren that my client, the father, brings this appeal. Your Honors, when the district court issued its order, it made some findings, which in our respectful submission are not supported by the evidence. And
Ms. Simonson, I was wondering, on the whole issue of the 25% parenting time.
Yes.
I pronounced your name correctly. Ms. Moberg makes, I thought, a dispositive on-point argument that, you know, that kicks in when you're trying to change things. It's not the initial determination. I agree with her. Why are she and I both wrong?
Your Honor, you are not wrong, nor is Ms. Moberg wrong. The law under 518.175 sub 1G is accurately recited. Actually, we cite that statute as well as Ms. Moberg, but I think Ms. Moberg makes the argument better than I do that presumption of 25% parenting time has been rebutted by the facts of this case. Normally, Your Honor, you're exactly right. Ms. Moberg is correct. If in the absence of any other facts, if the district court is asked the question, how much parenting time should we grant father? The law provides that the court should consider that it's in Oren's best interest that father is granted 25% parenting time. But we don't have an absence of other facts. In fact, we have a lot of facts to show, and the court accurately found in its order when it went through the best interest analysis and it made the finding in its order that there has been a prolonged absence between father and Oren.
The court went through the other 12 factors. And again, speaking for myself, not my treasured colleagues, you know, I thought the court made a pretty good record. Which of those 12 findings was wrong?
Your Honor, there are a couple, but if I could, I'd like to focus on one particular finding.
Go right ahead.
Thank you. Your Honor, the court made a finding that I don't think you'll see under the 12 best interest factors. What that finding is that the court found that Oren's best interests are served by not having parenting time in the father's home outside of the state of Minnesota for at least the next 5 years until he's age 10, when the gradually increasing parenting time schedule that the court laid out comes to its progressive end. At that point, there really isn't anything specific talking about what parenting time would look like. So following the court's logical scale, the parenting time schedule that the court set out would be unsupervised, in favor of father, granting some weekend parenting time, but still in the state of Minnesota. Your Honor, in my respectful submission, When the court made a finding that father's parenting time shall not take place outside of the state of Minnesota, that imposed a restriction or a limit on father's parenting time, which the court can do. The court has discretion when it's coming up with parenting time schedules to come up with limits or restrictions. There's no statutory definition of what a restriction is. This court has visited on that question of what a restriction looks like, normally in the context of a modification of parenting time. And this is not a modification case. This is an establishment case. We cited the Newstrand versus Arend case in our brief, which talks about restrictions that were imposed on a father in the establishment of a parenting time schedule. And in that case, Your Honors, the restrictions were upheld because the court made findings that the father, based on his past behavior with the minor child, was likely to impose some endangerment upon the child. I believe in that case, the facts involved some ongoing and substantial deprivation or interference with the child's relationship with the other parent. We don't have those facts here, Your Honors. In fact, there are no findings made by the district court.
Well, yeah, I have Newstrand in front of me, and I see your point, but I don't read Newstrand as limiting the parenting time to only those conditions when, you know, what you're talking about occurred. And, you know, once again, look, you know, I, you know, as I've always tried to tell my clerks, you know, it's not what I would have done. It's not what you would have done. It's whether what was done violates the statute and requires reversible in the applicable standard review. You know, maybe the visitation not out, you know, the restrictions on not outside the Minnesota, yeah, that seems kind of strict, but the issue is whether there's support for it in the record under the 12 factors. And I don't see that as clear error. So why am I wrong, Mr. Simonson?
Thank you, Your Honor, for asking that question. In this case, Your Honor, unlike Arend's, there are no facts that support what we submit as a restriction. And when you ask the question, Your Honor, why am I wrong? I think if we were to look a little further on in the statute that enumerates the 12 best interest factors, talking about 518.17 subdivision one, if we look to the next parenthetical under subdivision one, there are parentheticals 1B and 1C. Under those parentheticals, the court is instructed to consider the importance of maximizing Oren's relationship with both of his parents. Also, the court is required to assume that both parents are capable of nurturing and sustaining an ongoing healthy relationship with Oren. Our respectful submission, Your Honor, is that if the court is going to summarily discount the possibility that Oren could spend time in his father's home in Canada, that's ignoring what the legislature instructed the court to do when crafting a parenting time schedule. And again, I return to...
Well, then how do we deal with the language in the district court's order that says, in getting to that, you know, the district court cites, you know, given appellant's extensive absence and voluntary lack of involvement, missing important medical and physical therapy appointments, not being in touch with his emotional, medical, and other needs, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I understand your argument that there was a pandemic, and I can appreciate that. But, you know, am I wrong in stating that the record shows he was missing even the Zoom stuff? Would that be
your
a fair statement?
I do not dispute what Your Honor, okay. What Your Honor is saying.
Why doesn't that get us to say, you know, that's enough. There's a record there. She touched the district. I can't remember who the district court judge was. He or she, you know, got through the 12 factors and okay. You know, once again, yep. Seems like that's kind of harsh, but it's not like this is not unsupported by the evidence.
Yes, Your Honor. Fair question. The judge's name is Judge Rachna Sullivan, and Judge Sullivan, when she made a finding that there would be not only just no visits in father's home in Canada, but also no overnights for at least the next 3 years for Oren. Normally, there would need to be some finding that in spite of a voluntary absence, in spite of a long period of time where Oren didn't see his father, what would justify a restriction or a limit on father's parenting time? It would be one thing to develop a progressive schedule like the court did, and we don't dispute that. It's appropriate. There are several other courts that have come up with a progressive scale when there's been a period of attenuation or limited parenting time where the relationship, just like the child, needs to develop. What isn't supported in the record and what we submit is not supported in the law is the summary restriction to say child shall not have visits in father's home outside of the state of Minnesota, and child shall not have overnights for the next 3 years. I agree with Your Honor, it's a harsh penalty, but we submit that the harshness could be supported by the law if the court were to make a finding that such a harsh restriction is justified. And in our brief, we cite 518.175.1A, which talks about the court's duty to, upon request, come up with a parenting time schedule that promotes the child's health, development, healthy child-parent relationship. But immediately after that is another subdivision, which was cited in the Oren case we talk about, which talks about the court having the authority to impose restrictions. And again, we don't have a clear definition of what restrictions are, but I think we have it in this case when we're talking about limits on where the father can spend time with child and how long. But in order for that court to have a finding that those kinds of limits are appropriate, there would need to be some finding that there's a risk of harm to the child or endangerment. And in this case, we do have evidence of prolonged absence. We do have evidence of a severely eroded parent-child relationship that basically is kept on a lifeline by the Zoom calls. But we don't have any indication from the district court in its findings or on the record that father spending time with father would somehow endanger Oren.
Can I ask counsel, just so I understand, and I might misunderstand the legal argument. You referenced the 25% rebuttable presumption in your brief. I think I heard you say earlier that it was rebutted in this case.
Yes, right? That is correct.
So the only issue is your argument as to whether endangerment is a necessary finding to support the restriction out of state, or also to support the amount. I mean, what is it? What are the restrictions here that are not that require an endangerment finding in your view?
Thank you, Your Honor. First and foremost, the restriction from allowing father to exercise parenting time outside the state of Minnesota, especially in this case where the record is very clear that father does not live in Minnesota. He lives in Banff, Canada, and hopes that the child, Oren, would be able to visit him in Canada at some point. Now, the court doesn't categorically say father is prohibited, father could never bring a motion under Minnesota law to modify the parenting time schedule at some point. But what the father is set up for with the current language in the order is to overcome an argument that somehow having parenting time outside the state of Minnesota in father's home in Banff, Canada is going to represent some kind of harm to the child that father needs to overcome. It puts a burden of proof on father that he wouldn't otherwise have if he was living in International Falls or if he was living in Bemidji.
So the complaint is, to get back to my question, is about the restriction on location as opposed to the amount of time.
Thank you, Your Honor. Sorry, I got off track. The amount of time is also what we respectfully submit is a restriction. In this case, when the order was issued, Oren was 4 years old, and the parenting time schedule, as it's stated, doesn't allow overnight parenting time with father until Oren is 8 years old, which is a considerable amount of time when a child is 4 years old to have to wait to have an overnight with his father.
I know you're running out of time, that an endangerment finding was required in order to make those time.
Yes, that's our submission, Your Honor, because there is, again, because the statute is a little fuzzy on what a restriction is. We look at the plain meaning of the word restriction, which under the, if you were to look it up in the dictionary, a restriction is a limit or some kind of regulation that would otherwise impose some kind of limit on father's parenting time. And in this case, because the court made clear, we're putting limits on when father can have an overnight, we're putting limits on where father can see the child. In that case, the endangerment requirement would have to be met under subdivision 1B of 518.175. I see my time has expired. I thank you, Your Honors, for listening to my summary.
All right, and you'll have 5 minutes of time for rebuttal argument. We'll now hear from counsel for respondent. Please introduce yourself before you begin your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning, Your Honors. My name is Joni Moberg, and if it may please the court, I represent the respondent in this matter, Ellen Schneider. We primarily talked about parenting time so far, but there are three issues before the court, and appellant is coming to this court for help on all three. He represents himself as a wronged party, and I respectfully submit that in doing so, he has entirely distorted and misframed the case. He's not the wronged party, and the outcome in this case is entirely a product of his own action or really inaction. He could still remedy the fundamental problems in this case by simply engaging as a parent and answering discovery, but he chose to file this appeal instead. Mr. Simonson said the summons and petition for the dissolution started in 2018. It was actually March of 2019. They did separate in 2018. And Ms. Schneider served discovery the very following month. So that was April 19th of 2019. She sought standard information that we need to resolve divorce cases about income, assets, and debts. But instead of proceeding at that point, like cases normally do, the case stalled, and it's still stalled due to husband's inaction. After nearly a year of receiving nothing from husband, wife filed a motion to compel. That was granted. Still no discovery. So she filed a motion for contempt. That was granted. And since that time in 2020, September of 2020, husband has been in contempt and he has not remedied that contempt, even though he knows that he's incurring $100 a day fines. And we went to trial about it and still he hasn't complied. So it's been 3 years where this case has been stalled because his husband doesn't participate in the process. And yet he complains about it. It seems like the easiest solution would be for him to simply produce tax returns, bank statements, and credit card statements, but he won't do it. Even now that he has a lawyer, he won't do it. So here he is raising three issues: parenting time, his complaint that the court reserved the disposition of property in his control while awarding wife the property in her name, and then reserving the issue of dissipation. And but also the one issue the court did resolve for assets in his name was the disposition of farmland sale proceeds by determining that that was marital and awarding them equally to husband and wife. So let's start with parenting time. As Judge Connolly touched on, and I agree, an initial determination of custody and parenting time doesn't have anything in the statute relating to endangerment. The court simply has to decide what is in the best interest of the child. And that includes how much parenting time is going to happen and where it's going to happen. That's standard decisions that have to be made with regard to parenting time. Here, the limitations, let me back up. Yes, there is a presumption in the statute that it should be at least 25% parenting time, and that's based on overnights. Even if we didn't have any of the extraordinary circumstances present about husband's absenteeism as a parent, from day one of this child's birth, even if that wasn't the case, what we do have is people living in two different countries and a very young child. So even in an ordinary case with competent parents and involved parents, the 25% parenting time might not be something that could be accomplished in this case. But we do have the issue that even before the pandemic, husband was pretty much absent from this child's life. He did not rebut the fact that in 2018, he saw this child one time. There was no pandemic in 2018. He saw his child one time. So now we come to court at trial with an absentee father who's had chemical use issues, who seems to have ongoing issues that are not remedied because he appears for trial having requested a continuance three times and still being in contempt of court. So whatever issues he hasn't come and said, no problem, I've got those under control. I'm really behaving well now. The court can see with its own experience that he has issues of following orders, of being compliant, of doing what he's supposed to do, not just in parenting, but in other aspects of his life. The court made credibility findings that it's not even clear where he lives. He came to trial with us not knowing exactly where he lived. That had to come out in his testimony. So we have a four-year-old child who's barely ever seen his father, who lives in Minnesota. And the question isn't whether dad is going to have time with his child. The question is, where is the time going to happen? It's not a restriction to state that the time should happen in Minnesota. That's just reasonable. Someone's got to travel for this parenting time to happen. Maybe it should be the adult and not the four-year-old child. And it will be a long time before this child can travel from the United States to Canada without significant challenges because he will be in an unaccompanied minor crossing into another country. So it's perfectly reasonable that his time should happen in Minnesota. And I would submit that father should start by exercising the time that he's been awarded before he complains that he should have more time. So everything in the district court's decision related to custody and parenting time, I agree with Judge Connolly, was supported by copious findings. And because there was no motion for amended findings here, the question is, does the record support the facts and do the facts support the conclusions? And I would say that's uncontrovertibly the case. The district court did not abuse her broad discretion in the decision on custody. On the next issue of reserving...
Ms. Mulberg, could you skip to the property issue in terms of the gift yep. and the emails from the father relating
Absolutely.
To the...
Yep.
Thank you.
Absolutely. So on the issue of the farmland, that's a property issue that is routinely addressed in dissolution cases. Property is presumed to be marital. The person who asserts otherwise has the burden of proof of coming to court and demonstrating that that is not the case. So husband here came with a burden of proof. It's undisputed that this property was acquired and sold during the marriage. It's undisputed that when it was acquired, a mortgage was taken out. What isn't known is how much was it worth at the time that it was purchased or when it was acquired, and how much was it, you know, compared to how much was it worth when it was sold. So there are key components in husband meeting his burden that he didn't meet. First of all, he needed to prove that he acquired the property in a way that renders it non-marital property. Non-marital property being gifts, inheritance, or gifts, or have something you had before the marriage. It wasn't something he had before the marriage. It wasn't an inheritance. He claimed it was a gift. There was an email that he offered that he claims suggests it was a gift, but multiple places in the email refer to it as being a sale. So it was in the district court's discretion to say, you haven't met your burden on that. This evidence is conflicting. And it's more persuasive to me that this was a sale and not a gift. There's multiple pieces.
The district court on this issue, I know there were credibility findings and I know the father didn't testify. Did the district court make a specific credibility finding as to this issue with the farmland that, you know, I don't believe Mr. Simonson's client? Or did it have to?
I don't think that it had to. In general, it found that he was not credible. And on this issue, it said, you say it's a gift, the document says otherwise, and you didn't provide your father's testimony as any sort of a tiebreaker. So based on the evidence I have, I find it more persuasive that this was a sale and not a gift. And my client, Ms. Schneider, testified, even if it was a gift, I would want to hear from my former father-in-law as to whether that was a gift that was intended to just Mr. Schneider or whether it was intended for both of us, because I previously had a very close relationship with my in-laws, and it wouldn't have been all out of character for them to say, we're gifting this, but we're gifting it to both of you. So was it a gift to him? I don't think he met his burden to show that. Was it a gift at all? He didn't meet his burden to show that. Even if it was a gift, the next important step under the Schmidt formula that goes with tracing on non-marital property is how do we figure out what his non-marital claim was? If it was a gift, we very much need to know what the value of the property was at the date that it was acquired, because was there equity in it? We don't even know that. It could have been a gift, but if there wasn't any equity, it doesn't create a non-marital claim. There are multiple places in the chain of tracing that Mr. Schneider completely failed to meet his burden. And so the district court was well within her broad discretion in determining that this was marital property. That's pretty much my arguments on that, Your Honor. Do you have any further questions?
I do not. Thank you, Ms. Mulmer.
Okay. Then I'll skip back to the reservation issue. First of all, on this, there's no evidence that Mr. Schneider objected to this request and the granting of this request at or after trial. He did not file motion for amended findings. And so the court could just affirm the district court on that alone. But if the court does consider the substantive argument, that's also well supported by the law. There are many available sanctions under the law, under the rules of civil procedure, when a party is in contempt of court and refuses to provide discovery responses. And here, I was scratching my head and so was the district court. How are we supposed to draft a judgment and decree disposing of all the property when we don't know what all the property is? We simply could not do anything other than reserve the issue of husband's property because we didn't know what it was for the most part, with the exception of the farm proceeds. We did know what wife's property was, and why should she be punished for husband's contemptuous behavior in not disclosing her property by having for an unknown amount of time in the future, it being unclear whether she owned things like her retirement and her bank account? It was reasonable to award her property, and it was reasonable that the issue of husband's property had to be reserved. I frankly couldn't think of any other solution. I have been doing this a while. And then on the issue of the dissipation, my client raised a colorable claim that there had been dissipation, that husband was in relationships in the deterioration of their relationship when divorce was being contemplated, where he was spending a lot of money on those relationships and on other things that were not benefiting the marriage. She raised a colorable claim, including exhibits that suggested, you know, she had some information about funds that had been spent. But having raised that colorable claim, she was unable to fully develop it because she needed credit card statements and bank statements that husband refused to provide, which is perhaps why he's refused to provide them for 3 years. You know, there's two options there. He can't, it's too hard for him, or there's something in it he doesn't want us to see. Either way, he is the reason why that claim couldn't be fully developed, and it was reasonable and equitable for the court to reserve that issue as well. And that's all I have to say about that point as well. So if there are no further questions, then I have made my argument.
Any questions? Right, I'm not seeing any, and we thank you for your argument. We'll hear from Mr. Simonson on rebuttal now.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honors. So I'd like to pick up very briefly where I left off with regard to the issue of parenting time. I know that the court made findings and there was a record made of father's chemical dependency issues, and Ms. Moberg alluded to that issue in her summation. And in terms of the absenteeism with parenting time, I don't know that father had control over his chemical dependency issue, but father did seek treatment. There is a record to indicate that father was receiving treatment in British Columbia while the dissolution, during the party's period of separation leading up to the dissolution. In this case, I recognize that the court is required to make findings as to what's in Oren's best interests in order to render a parenting time schedule, not to punish or penalize or in some way respond to or address the parents' behavior. The question is really, is it in Oren's best interest to have parenting time with his father? And if so, does that parenting time allow Oren to spend time in his father's home? And in this case, the court made the finding that it was not in his best interest to have parenting time in father's home. And our question is why? What is the basis for the court to make that finding? And we submit that there is no basis for such a finding or such a conclusion. I want to move on to the issue of the non-marital property that father raised during the trial and the court's findings. We respectfully submit, Your Honors, that father did introduce sufficient evidence both to for the court to make a finding as to value of the property, but also for the court to make findings as to donative intent. The email that the court alluded to in its questioning of Ms. Mulberg was part of the court's record. The email refers to an intent on the part of Father's family to come up with a succession plan for farmland in Saskatchewan, Canada. And there's also evidence that the value of the property, the value of the land, exceeded the purchase price. Father introduced at trial several different objective measures of farmland in Kneehill County, where the 160 acres is located, that would support a finding that the farmland was worth considerably more than $350,000. The evidence also shows that was introduced at trial that Father purchased the property by taking out a loan through a farm credit program that operates in Canada. So there was no marital equity that was put down toward the purchase of this property. As Ms. Mulberg alluded to the Schmitz case allows a court to trace the appreciation in marital equity in a non-marital asset. In this instance, Your Honors, there was no marital equity put into the purchase of this farmland because it was entirely purchased through financing. Moreover, the court in this case demurred.
Were there no payments on the mortgage?
Yes, Your Honor. You're exactly right. There were payments on the mortgage, not at the time of purchase, but at the time as the loan was amortized before the period of sale. So there would be a small marital component that the court would need to trace. So you are quite right.
Was that evidence all presented to the district court to allow that tracing?
The purchase price, as well as the sale price and the payoff at the time of sale, Your Honor, were all provided. So it would be possible for the court to come up with a marital amount at the time of sale. So, Your Honor, when it comes to the farmland, there was evidence of donative intent. There was evidence of value in excess of purchase price. And there was evidence that the father's father, in this case, Mr. Schneider, intended for his son, not in this case, the mother, the respondent, to be the recipient of this property. It was a family succession plan. And even mother testified at trial in the transcript. She indicated that she was aware that the father's family had this plan in place to either gift property to father and his brother, or to come up with a plan to capitalize the family business as a way of selling the farmland to create capital. So in this case, Your Honor, the intent was for the land to stay within the father's family, and there was evidence of equity that was gifted to father. Very briefly, Your Honor, I'll just touch upon the issue of the reservation. The court in this case, under section 518.58, has a duty to render a fair and equitable division. Your Honor, may I briefly wrap up? I'm sorry, I'm out of time. Thank you.
One minute.
Thank you. Given that the reservation does the opposite of render a fair and equitable division, it leaves indefinitely whether or not property can and will be fairly and equitably divided. It gives total control to the respondent, the mother, to decide whether and when this property division.
That issue could be resolved if, as Ms. Mulberg indicated, your client had, shown all the cards. I mean, would that be a fair statement, Mr. Simonson? Wouldn't be in this reservation of property issue if everybody had shown all the stuff and then, okay, well, there you go. That's for you. This is in between, et cetera, et cetera. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes, Your Honor. If I could add the modifier that it would have to ultimately be the district court that decides whether or not Father fully complied with discovery. Otherwise, it's leaving it up.
Well, is there any doubt about that? I mean, good Lord, I read the order. That seems pretty clear. She didn't think your client was doing that.
Absolutely. At this point, Your Honor, you're absolutely right. Father produced 500 pages of discovery, but that wasn't enough. This discovery issue could be a bit of a game of cat and mouse. It's a moving needle. We don't know where it will land. But ultimately, it's doubtful that the parties would reach an accord on whether or not discovery was satisfied, and it would likely have to be the district court to decide whether or not this issue of discovery can be closed. So to that, those are my comments. Thank you, Your Honors, for listening to our argument. I appreciate very much your time today.
All right. Thank you. The matter is submitted. We appreciate your arguments and briefing. You'll have our decision within the time required by statute. That concludes the court's oral hearings this morning. We'll now move to our non-oral submissions.